You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruryak. There was a time when there wasn't a phrase or any common language for the experience of being mistreated in a sexual way at work. The phrase sexual harassment hadn't been coined, though women of all ages and all generations could tell stories that fit the description of what that phrase would come to mean. In the studio with me is the journalist who spent time thinking about what to call this behavior, and in 1975, she originated the phrase sexual harassment. She wrote a groundbreaking book titled Sexual Shakedown. There was a documentary, and a movement continued. She is Dr. Lynn Farley, and she's in our studio. Welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Will you tell the story of naming this behavior? And it starts in a class you were teaching at Cornell University about women and work.
Right. I was teaching a 15-credit field study course on women and work, and I had recruited so that I had both black and white female students, but it suddenly dawned on me that I was going to be put these Cornell co-eds in the field with working women, union members, welfare mothers, and I thought, you know, this could be a disaster from both sides, so I decided to do a little CR session about women in work and their work experience. And every single one of these kids from all over the country, I had 15 girls, and had an experience of either leaving a job or being fired because they would not respond positively to the sexual overtures of a manager, a boss, or even a coworker who had authority over them. And I remember just being stunned. I remember sitting there when the class was over and thinking, this is an issue. It is something that we all have experienced, and we have no name for it, so we keep calling it different things. Over here, one woman says, oh, he hit on me, and he just wouldn't take for an answer. And over here, we have a woman who says, you know, the guy was like an octopus. His hands were everywhere. We had a million ways to describe it, but not one phrase that was able to sum it up so that we all could be having the same conversation, talking about the same thing.
So you literally spent hours, days, over a couple of weeks thinking about how to name this.
That's right. And I talked with my friends and colleagues. We kept, you know, I kept coming up with this idea or that idea. I looked at coercion. I looked at blackmail. I looked at I just went through so many permutations and possibilities of how to describe this. And finally, it seemed to me sexual harassment of women on the job was the closest that we were going to get. And harassment captures the whole range of behavior because we go from offensive looks to offensive conversation all the way up through and including rape and sexual assault. But you have to get that whole range because women leave jobs because of that. I had a woman who told me that every morning her boss came in and he said to her as he walked by, "Hiya tits, how they hanging today?" And she left her job within a few months. I mean, how would you like to have, you know, if a man puts himself in those shoes, some guy comes in and says, "Hey, how are your balls? What's going on?" They're not going to take it. And this woman couldn't take it either. So I think we need to look at the whole range of offensive sexual behavior on the job.
It's so interesting to me that you were looking at it in a way in 1975 that still holds true today. Do you think the phrase means almost exactly what it did then, now?
Yes, exactly. I've got the long view here, 40 plus years of looking at what happens around this issue, what happens when we talk about it. It seems like every 15 years we reinvent the wheel. So in 1975, it was Lynn Farley and sexual harassment was named. The first syndicated article came out in the New York Times. Women responded overwhelmingly. 15 years later, we had Anita Hill, and it was like sexual harassment got reinvented all over again. And now we have Me Too and Christine Blasey Ford and another wave of sexual harassment awareness and focus, etc. But it seems as if we have these waves there's tremendous interest. It seems as if we're making progress, and then it sort of all goes back down again until the next whatever that brings it all back into the public attention.
Because you said Anita Hill and Dr. Ford, I want to add the name that preceded that, which is Carmita Wood.
Yes. Carmita was a secretary at Cornell University. She had worked her way up over years, very wonderful woman who had gone as far as she could go in terms of what an administrative woman could do at Cornell. And she was sexually harassed by Cornell's only Nobel Prize winning physicist. She had to leave her job. She applied for unemployment insurance and was turned down. And, of course, she didn't have a way to talk about it either. She didn't say I was sexually harassed on the job. But anyway, we got together and I said, we'll take your case. We'll appeal your unemployment claim. But you need to be willing to talk about this issue, and that's going to make you fairly notorious in the town of Ithaca. So I want you to go home. I want you to think about it very carefully. I want you to talk to your family, because this is a big step that you're going to take. And she came back at the end of the weekend and said she was ready. Carmita was a fighter, and we did take her unemployment claim, but she talked about what happened to her in vivid detail, and that's extremely important. Carmita was, I would say, a very courageous woman, and she did a great job in terms of talking about sexual harassment. At the same time, you had a black woman, Diane Williams, who sued the Justice Department of the United States. Those two were extremely early pioneers, one black, one white.
Carmita Wood didn't have anyone else to look to for guidance. She knew she was standing alone in the trail she was blazing.
Yes. Well, she had us. And when she became unemployable in Ithaca, which she did, I got her hired at HAP. And she worked with the Human Affairs Program for a while. And then when the Human Affairs Program disbanded, she moved down to Florida and kind of started a new life there. But her life essentially was employable anyway, was over in Ithaca when she came out and was a spokesperson.
What have you come to understand about how sexual harassment is used as a strategy or a tool, or I'll be stronger in the wording, a weapon? In the workplace,
it is a weapon in the workplace. In non-traditional job areas for women, it is a technique that is used to keep women out, to harass them literally until they just don't want any part of the job. In traditional female job areas, it keeps high turnover, so you don't have to pay higher wages. You don't have to deal with unionization. You see it in the fast food industry. You know, young girls are like Kleenex in the fast food industry. And I would say, I mean, I can't prove it at this point, but within that industry, it's well known that sexual harassment is an issue and nothing is done about it because it keeps turnover high and they don't have to deal, like I said, with higher wages, et cetera.
So in those 15-year cycles that you're describing, is there change with each cycle?
No. I am a doomsayer, I'm afraid. I've got 40-plus years at this. I haven't seen much change at all. You have more sexual harassment cases today than you did probably when I was starting out. We have not made a dent on this issue. And, you know, every 15 years, it seems as if women kind of reinvent the wheel. I talked with Gretchen Carlson, did a long interview with her. She sued, you know, Roger Ailes at Fox, got $20 million. She thinks she invented sexual harassment. It was the same thing with Anita Hill. Anita Hill never talked about the women who came before her, about the movement that whose shoulders she stood on. And it was only like 10 to 15 years that the whole issue got started. This seems to be a phenomenon in women's history. I know when the second wave of the women's movement started, we all thought that we had invented many of these issues. But when I started reading, we hadn't invented these issues at all. They had been around in the first wave. So I think this is something we also need to address. We have to stop thinking every 15 years that we're making huge progress because we're talking about something that 15 years ago women were talking about.
Maybe we haven't spoken enough, because you were going to be here today, I had a conversation on my way to work with my mom, who worked as a nurse her entire career. I heard stories today, Dr. Farley, that I have never, ever heard. And they just kept pouring out and pouring out. And I have a great relationship with my mom. Why did we never have this conversation before? Anyway, we're going to take a short break. Will you stay with us?
Of course.
We're going to talk a little bit more about where your work is today. This is Dr. Lynn Farley. By the way, she has two public lectures tomorrow at noon in Davis. She will be at the UC Davis Genome and Biomedical Science Facility Auditorium. And then tomorrow at 5 p.m. in Sacramento at the UC Davis Sacramento Campus Education Building, the Matsui Lecture Hall, she'll speak again. We'll be right back. Our conversation will continue on Insight. More now with author and journalist Dr. Lynn Farley, who in 1975 originated the phrase sexual harassment. We're talking today on the one-year anniversary of the We Said Enough letter that was published and signed by more than 100 women in California politics. You published an op-ed a year ago at this time, and in the op-ed, not directly related to the We Said Enough letter, you wrote about the fact that the decades, you said, have been disappointing, that sexual harassment as a concept has been a success, but it's done far less to encourage what you had envisioned back in 1975, which would flourish. Would you say something about that?
I thought working women you would unite around the issue. I thought it was an issue that cut through all of the class, race lines that divides women at work. It's something that happens to all working women, regardless of age, regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of class background, regardless of race. And I thought, like rape, it would unite women and there would be a revolution for women at work.
Why hasn't that happened?
Well, you know, number one, women are so unheard in our culture that when they are heard, they stop there. We're so grateful to be listened to. We are so grateful that somebody is paying attention to our experience. And I think it's very critical that we move beyond that. We move beyond being grateful. If you look at Christine Blasey Ford, she was so eloquent. She was so careful in her speech and her demeanor. You know, it was a big deal for her to come forward and talk about what she did. Let's not talk about the guy on the other side and his behavior. But I think we have to stop being nice and we have to stop being grateful that we're being listened to and we have to take it to the next step. We have to say, you know, it's great that you're listening to us, but now we want it to stop.
How different would that hearing have been if she had come out angry and blazing and in some of the emotion that he came out with?
I don't know. We don't know because we don't risk it. As women, we very rarely take that chance. I don't know what would have happened. I don't think it could have been worse. I think, you know, you had 13 men on that committee that were the same 13 men that crucified Anita Hill almost, what, how many years ago? The same men sitting on the committee crucifying another woman.
So there was a time when you dipped out of this whole arena, too. You pulled back. And I have heard you say in videos that you were tired of being that sexual harassment lady.
Right.
And you wanted to take a break. Part of that was because of the pounding you were taking.
That's true. You know, when Sexual Shakedown, the book, came out, I did every major radio and TV show in America. And then I did another round when the paperback came out. And again, you know, I'm sort of talking about myself. I was very grateful. I was so happy that people were listening to me and I had an opportunity, a platform to get the information out there and to reach other women. But, you know, every show that I showed up for, the woman producer would come out and say, "Oh, Lynn, it's a groundbreaking work. We're all so impressed. But, you know, Johnny or Merv or Jack is going to appear to attack you because it'll be better box office." And I just went along and said, "Okay, yes, sure." And all I did when they were beating me up, and they did, was try and get the information out there to the audience. And later on, I realized that took a toll. It's very hard when you don't stand up for yourself, when you don't say enough, when you don't say you can't do that. The only time that I really stood up was on a radio show in Chicago, and the host was very polite and nice to me. But two girls called in when I talked about the fast food industry who were working at a place where they had to perform sexual favors in order to keep their job. And those two kids needed that job. And when they called in and talked about their experience, he and they went off the air. He called them whores. He said, "Those little whores." And I said, "Whoa, you know, you can say whatever you want to me, but you cannot insult these kids because I'm on your show." And they felt safe enough to call in. And I said, "We're done." And I walked off the show. And of course, you know, that's something you don't do. You do not leave the leader of the show with dead airtime. And I thought, oh, God, McGraw-Hill is going to really crucify me now. They're going to be so upset. It turned out that was not the case. They were, like, elated because people ran out and bought the book. So it was good publicity for them. I think they went so far as to say, "Can you do it again?" And I was like, "Well, I don't think so."
Let me fast forward to where your work has resurfaced. You jump back into this, taking the perspective of the socialization of men. You did your doctorate work on this, and all of that was before this year when we've been so focused on Kavanaugh and the Me Too movement. So what are you looking at now? What have you been writing about?
Well, you know, my doctoral dissertation was The Secret World of Men. Men's attitudes, beliefs, behaviors, and desires with regard to women and children. And, you know, we socialize men to behave this way. We need to face that. Men are socialized to be attracted to younger, smaller sex objects. We're appalled when we see men, you know, sleeping with 12-year-old girls or whatever, or when we see Western men lined up too deep around the block in Thailand to go to a brothel where they have 8- and 9-year-old girls for sale. But this is the way we socialize men. This is what we teach them to want. Now, we also have the pornography. You know, in my book, The Secret World of Men, I have a fellow who told me, he comes right out and talks about it. He cannot sleep with his wife anymore because he's so far gone on pornography that he cannot get it off unless he has some sort of pornographic behavior going on, and he doesn't want to do that to his wife. The man sat and cried, and this is all stuff going on under the radar that we're not talking about and we're not looking at.
So now you are talking about yet another social revolution that would have to happen. Is the first and critical step in that this dialogue and openness about the reality, the victim stories, if you will?
I think the victim stories are important, but we have never really moved on to the perpetrator stories, and we need the perpetrator stories. What motivates you to do this? Why do you behave this way? What's going on with you? You know, little boys do not pop out of the womb all set to behave this way.
But we don't get those stories if the response is, "What do you mean? I don't do it. I didn't do it."
Well, you know, the truth is, I think probably half of the men in the workforce do it. And the other half look the other way, don't want to get involved, wash their hands of it, because they do not want to appear to contradict other men in the workplace. I mean, that's a huge other issue that goes on with men. Men will not contradict each other. If they don't approve of what's going on, but they will not. I'll give you an example of this. I did a show in Chicago. It was another call-in show. And a lawyer called in, and truthfully, he bested me in the conversation, and he kept saying, "Look, I'm a lawyer. I hire nothing but pretty women, and you're not going to stop me from doing it." And I just sort of was constantly playing catch up with him. And when the show was over, the producer came out and said, "You know, 4 men called in and said he's a total jerk. He's not liked in the profession, and they know what he's doing with women." And I said, "Why didn't you put them on the air?" And he said, "They wouldn't go on the air. They were willing to talk about it privately." And that goes on with men all the time. You will have a man go up to a woman who's being harassed and say, "I'm sorry. I see what's happening. I know it's wrong." But they will not stand up.
Meanwhile, How many women have been sexually harassed? What's your guess?
You know, the statistics have never changed. 40 years ago, when we did the Red Book questionnaire, 70% of women said they had been sexually harassed. If you look at the stats that have come out around the Me Too movement, 70% of women are saying they are sexually harassed in the workplace. It has not varied. It has not changed. It's way more than 50% or half. And if a woman hasn't experienced it directly, she has seen it in the workplace. She's seen it with other women. It's phenomenally widespread.
So what are you hopeful about in your lifetime as your work continues? Because it seems that you are reconnected and reinvested.
I would love to see the book about how we socialize men to behave this way. I would like to see that see the light of day. But I think we also need to understand.
Do you mean it doesn't have a publisher?
No, it doesn't.
You can't get it published?
I haven't really tried very hard. I'm waiting for an agent to come and find me. But I think also working women need to look to themselves for this. I don't think management is going to do it. I don't think HR programs are going to do it. Women need to organize on the job themselves. And I think that's going to be the next step.
Dr. Farley, it has been a pleasure. I appreciate this time with you, and I'm glad that you're here for two public lectures for people who want to hear more from you.
Thank you.
So Dr. Farley will be at Davis, at the UC Davis Genome and Biomedical Science Facility tomorrow at noon. Her speech is Sexual Harassment Today, Yesterday, and Tomorrow. And then at 5 p.m. tomorrow, she's at the UC Davis Sacramento campus, the Education Building. Her speech is Sexual Harassment, The Backstory. I think you could end up on tour again. I hope that book gets published. And I want to offer you a standing invitation to come and join us at any point that you're in the area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That is Dr. Lynn Farley. Our conversation on this topic will continue after a short break. This is Insight on CAP Radio.